It is Saturday, November 26th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. In the first half of the show, we'll be doing geek news. In the second half, we'll take your calls and questions and comments about technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. This is Central Coast Public Radio. My name is Lyle Troxell. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Mr. Miles Elam. He's a programmer and political analyst. Hi.
Political analyst now.
I'll go with that.
Political junkie. Yeah.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, for the geek news, go ahead and start, sir.
I want to start off with just some real geekiness.
Like okay.
Sorting algorithms. Now, for all those out there that know how to program and that have been doing it for a little while, you know, the sorting algorithm can make a huge difference with your data. I mean, just night and day. Your choice of algorithms in general is what determines how fast your program is, not the language it's written in or the environment or the operating system you're writing on. And
if you want to be a better programmer, get better at algorithms.
Yes. Yeah. And the site that I just came across is one given off by the University of Waterloo in Canada. And it talks about different types of sorting, and it shows you how they work visually. You have to have Java installed because they do run as Java applets, but they take a randomized data set, in this case, lines of varying lengths, some of them very short, some of them very long, and sorts them so that they're going from small to large.
Mm-hmm.
And you get an idea of how they each work, and you get an idea of how long each one takes to run through. And I've when people call in saying, well, how do you get your mind around this? Or how do you program? Or how do I learn how this stuff works? Or how do I get started? I highly recommend looking at something like this.
And it's cool, even if you're not programming, to really get a grasp on it. It's a really neat thing to look at.
Right. Because most people, you think of, let's say you have a bunch of index cards and you're sorting them. They each have a word on them and you're sorting them by alphabetical order. And so you go through your own setup, and some people go through it faster than others. Some have a better method than others, that type of thing. But most people don't think about the very different ways that you can possibly sort those index cards, mm-hmm. and how much faster it can be or how much slower it can be.
Right.
And it's really fascinating to see that and to see, so when a program is slow, it's not necessarily because the person was, writing for a slow operating system or just using a whole bunch of memory, or that there are always trade-offs, that you have very simple sorting algorithms like bubble sort.
So where can you learn more about these? I mean, what is this that you're referencing?
This is on the University of Waterloo, Canada mm-hmm. Website, and we will be putting the link up on the website after the show.
Geekspeak.org.
Mm-hmm. But that idea of if you have a really large data set, and when I say really large,
millions,
we're talking millions or billions.
Mm-hmm.
And so your choice of algorithm really matters a lot because you have so many things that you need to sort. Whereas so it doesn't really matter to set up that algorithm takes a little bit more effort,
mm-hmm.
because once it's running, it's going to outweigh that constant, buildup time, as opposed to a bubble sort, which really is not that efficient for a large data set. But it's really simple to set up.
Yeah.
So if you only have 10 items that you need to sort,
why not?
Why not? So if you're more, if you're interested in this topic, or just to see what it looks like, just to see the program from the programmer's point of view rather than the graphical user interface, you know, from the interface that you normally see, check out geekspeak.org after the show.
All right. I want to mention a little discussion I was having with somebody about ovens. And turkey time comes around in the United States, and we all spend a lot of time in our ovens, which we don't normally do necessarily. And there's a discussion, the discussion that I was kind of engaging with or listened to and decided not to really try to explain it was an idea of how do you preheat your oven quick? And so the person that I watched do this heated the oven, set the temperature to the oven a lot higher than they wanted to set it, than they wanted the target temperature to be, thinking that that would be a faster heating time. So I wanted to engage in that discussion about how ovens work, in that, Miles, what you said right off the bat. So you knew exactly the same thing that I knew, but I didn't. I just said not to engage. I just had to keep on making pie and not really.
If it was possible to get an oven to a particular temperature that quickly, all ovens would do it immediately. Like, right. 400 degrees there, 600 degrees. There, and that's faster rate, and so people go like, "Oh, if I'm going to 600, it's going to go at a faster rate." No, it's just going to take longer.
And this is true about this problem that emerges. It's true about electrical electrical ovens, and also gas ovens, propane or a natural gas. The general idea is that it's a lot more complicated to put all the smarts inside the oven to have a heating system that they'd use in more technically savvy environments, right? Where you say, I want my temperature to be this temperature, and therefore heat up my system until it reaches that temperature. Don't go above that temperature and stay exactly at that temperature. To do that, you have to actually look, you have to use an algorithm. You have to actually look at the heat increase path and try to lower the volume of heating, if you will, so that it matches to a ceiling that's perfect. And you'll see that espresso machine aficionados like these kinds of machines, right? They get the temperature to the right temperature and they just stay there.
Oh, I was thinking about it in a completely different angle.
Well, your angle is totally a valid way of thinking of it. But I was just talking about the technical reason why.
No, I was actually thinking of a serious limitation to doing that, which is when you're generating heat, you are not doing this in a vacuum. You are doing it where you have air or other materials in that oven that are at room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
To begin with,
including the side of the oven,
right,
that
are at 75 degrees, sure. Or give or take, and or if you have a comfortable house, or 70, whatever,
20 degrees C, sir, keep it fresh.
Sure, yes, and if you wanted to have that heated up quickly, you need to have a requisite much higher temperature on that element.
Right.
So if you wanted something to go from 20 degrees C to, let's say, 150 degrees C.
Uh-huh. You want to have an output source that's up in the 500 range, right? You basically want as hot an element as you can structurally contain so that your temperature can increase quickly.
Right, but if you wanted to have it in, really fast, like within like a 10-second margin, that element has to be much hotter than 150 degrees C.
And, of course, the food that's in the oven is going to affect its rating temperature. When you have a large turkey, for example, that turkey meat all has to get to
The idea here is you're preheating the oven.
Right, so the preheating oven is a little simpler. But what I was talking about much more is that you could do a situation where the temperature output was varying so that you'd get to a curve that would maximize at the temperature, 350 degrees C, 350 degrees Fahrenheit that you want, right, or for whatever, those average ranges that we deal with. You could do it such that you could modify the amount of temperature you're adding to the system by small amounts. But to do that means that you've got to vary your power source. And to do that, you've got to have some kind of valve that opens and releases more or less heat. Now, the stovetop on a gas range, electrical range, is like that. You can actually have a small amount of heat or a higher amount of heat. And the reason for that is that there's no temperature sensing device on top of the stove. You don't actually know what your temperature is going to. You know, if you're trying to boil some eggs, you maximize the heat. If you're trying to get a kettle, you maximize it. If you're cooking some scrambled eggs on top of the stove fan, you know, you might preheat the oven, the stove top a little hotter and then turn it down. You're actually varying the amount of power. The oven doesn't work that way. The oven has a sensor in it, a thermometer, that checks the temperature all the time. And by that temperature reading, decides if it's going to turn on or off a switch. It's a binary operation. And the reason for that really has to do with the complexity of trying to calculate out. You'd have to have a computer in there to figure out if you wanted to vary the temperature so that you turn it on maximum until it got close to 350, and then you slowly faded it out until it reached 350, and then you got a perfect 350. Ovens don't actually do that. They rely on a large volume of air. And so what you're doing is you throw on your heat. The sensor says, hey, I'm at 350. It turns it off. The temperature keeps rising to about 360, 380. Then it starts to fall. And once it gets past that 350 temperature setting that you've dialed in, it goes, hey, I'm too low. And it turns it on full blast again. So you really have the envelope, the stove envelope is going to vary by, 10, 15 degrees easy around the temperature that you want.
That actually reminds me of flood lamps, like security lamps outside your house. Imagine, if you will, that that was on a dimmer.
Oh, I love that.
In other
that
words, just something that kind of gradually came up or came down. How much more complex that would be, that it catches that someone's moving there and the light kind of turns up a little bit. And then if it sees more movement, then it moves up a little bit more. And then if there's a whole bunch of movement, like there are five people,
then it goes up. It's funny because that would be a much better device, wouldn't it? You'd pull up with your car, instead of getting blinded, it would slowly fade up.
It depends on what you're using it for. Because if a burglar is coming by, or someone's coming to TP your house or something like that, you want the light to come on immediately.
I like the burglar one because the light turns on, it stops moving. They could have a sound system going, I see you. And the light come on more. They move.
But that's a lot more complex than just going, movement, light.
Right. So we really have crude devices in our ovens that do this. And unfortunately, if you target your temperature. Now, there's one reason to get your temperature higher, to preheat the oven higher than you actually want. If you've got something like I was cooking a pumpkin pie, right? And when you pour in your pumpkin, your stuff before you cook it, it's very liquidy, right? And I didn't produce my crust up high enough. So as I put my pumpkin pie in, I had to take a little bit of time doing that. And every time I open the oven, I'm realizing, well, I'm going to drain a whole bunch of heat out of the system. So right off the bat, it's going to be a lot cooler than it was intending to do. So if I was targeting at a certain temperature, 425, and I could put it at 450, and when it beeped at 450, I could open it up, turn it down to 425, slide my pie in, and most likely get a little closer to the temperature when it first started. Mm-hmm. But anyway, as everyone knows, cooking is not a science. There's a little bit of bad technology in there that makes it an art.
Which actually reminds me of another little tidbit. Mm-hmm. Since we're on the topic of efficiency and heat transfer, I saw online a discussion about which is better, to heat your house to a certain temperature and leave it at that point. So like you set your thermometer to 68 degrees, let's say, and leave it like that all day, or when you leave to let it cool off and then just as you're getting home to turn it back on again. Which is more efficient? And there are a lot of people that would say, oh, well, you want to keep the house at a constant temperature. To crank up that heat to get it up to the level that you want is going to be more energy intensive. Turns out it's not. And it's very easy to figure this out. And this works for a lot of different scenarios. Mm-hmm. This is a basic property of physics. And if you understand it, you can figure out, deduce for yourself how efficient certain things are going to be. So in this case, I want you to think of your house as a leaky bucket.
Okay.
And when you put, and think of heat as a liquid.
Okay, so I've got my wood stove and I'm putting in wood stove, which means I'm trying to fill up my bucket with heat.
Right.
Okay.
And as you're filling it in with this slow trickle, the bucket is leaking the entire time.
Okay.
And the thing is, it's going to leak no matter what. There's no possible way that you could make your house in such a way that it is not going to leak some heat.
Right.
Fundamental principle of physics. You just trust us on this one. And if you, on the other hand, let the bucket go empty for a while, the amount of energy it would take to fill up the bucket to get to the point where you're comfortable again is going to be less over the course of a day if you're away for work than it would be if you were the amount of leakage that you're going to get from your house. You may have less leakage if you have double pane glass and the like, but you're always going to have that leakage.
In fact, if you didn't have that leakage, when we talked about the oven earlier, my wood stove. Do you have a wood stove at your house? What do you have for heating?
Central heat.
Central heat. Okay. So the central heat's like a little, well, maybe it's the same kind of thing. The actual heating element is a flame. And yours is central heating. It's a bluish flame, right? So we're talking about 2,600 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah,
bluish really, flame if it's, everything's working. Yeah.
And my house, I use a wood stove mostly, and that wood stove is burning probably at a really hot fire with a coal bed and everything, like 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? I'm using Wikipedia fire entry, by the way. Look at temperatures for based off light.
1,800, really?
Yeah, yeah. It, right here, it's great. It's got all by color, right? So just visible red fire is 980 degrees Fahrenheit. Going up, and it says the temperature.
Should we be doing that C value loudly and whisper the Fahrenheit?
So just visible, dull red, a cherry dull red, a cherry full, a cherry clear, and then it goes into the oranges, deep and clear, and then it's white, and whitish means like a bright and a dazzling. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of different
ranges. Right, but this is not uniform. It's going to be white at the very center, and then as you go out, it's going to get cooler and
cooler.
Absolutely,
and it gets more complicated.
The stove
than that, of
itself
too.
Is not necessarily that hot.
So that's the thing that's interesting, of course, is that a wood stove, you've got your coal bed in there. That's at a much higher temperature. The outside of the wood stove is still hot. You know, you don't want to touch it, but it's at a lower temperature. And then outside of that, the house gets cooler and cooler as you get away from the fireplace. If you had a perfectly sealed place for heat, you didn't lose anything. Your entire house would get to, eventually, that cherry red 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The entire house would, which would be very bad for us. I mean, the way we use radiant heat is assuming there's going to be a lot of loss.
Right. Technically, all you would need is your own body heat to heat the house up to a point that would be uncomfortable.
And that's the thing about it. The less you leak in that bucket, the easier it is to heat it up, right? That idea of the bucket home. Yeah, I think that's a good way
to think about it. Well, heating up the air is going to be fairly uniform, although you're going to have more loss in a house that has like holes in the roof or something like that.
But, right. I mean, I've got an old house. It's just leaky. I mean, the windows aren't double panes. There's cracks. The more you fill those cracks, the better, of course, you get. That's why curtains are such a good thing too, right? Around windows is that has to do with the thermal transfer between the glass. If you can produce a cloth barrier in front of that, then there'll be less airflow behind it. And therefore there'll be a buffer there of cooler temperature that will be harder to transfer through the cloth, right? So anyway.
Now, that does bring up an interesting point when you talk about a fireplace or a wood-burning stove, which is sometimes you do want to keep the coals warm. You want to keep them insulated because that's a lot easier to get the fire back again. And if it's a low burn, then it's not going to burn very quickly.
Right.
And so that's...
And it's tricky, of course, with the fireplace where you're feeding the fire, the oxygen, the air from the house itself, which means the house has to continually put air out the chimney. You're actually drawing cool air from any of your leaks into the house. It's actually not a very efficient way to heat a house. It'd be much better if you just use as a radiant and you had an outside source for the airflow. And the air, you know, the chimney's intake was outside and the output was outside. You'd actually have less of a low pressure that was pulling cold air in from outside. But try to figure that out. I think actually the new gas stoves do that now. The chimneys are actually a two-way flow. Should we go on to more geek news, Miles?
Sure. Moving on to a different topic. Don't normally talk about the ACLU on this show. It's an area that isn't necessarily one that fits with geek speak. A lot of times we'll talk about the Electronic Freedom Foundation because they tend to be more technical, the technical end of things. But in this case, the ACLU on their blog has what I thought a very pertinent discussion about license plate scanners that I thought would be interesting for the listeners of Geek Speak out there, and also is made in such a way that's very easy to follow and understand. And it talks about the fact that many areas are setting up license plate scanners for the police, that actually, and not just for the police, but stationary tracking devices to be able to see what license plates go by.
We covered a couple years ago, we had a sheriff or a police officer from San Jose come in and talk about the tech they use, because he's an online specialist of crimes online, and talk about the tech that he had. And he mentioned this thing of all the cameras in all the squad cars have cameras that are continually scanning. They know their location. They know where the cars show up because of the footage. Any car they see, they automatically OCR it, find out what license is, and keep a record of that, a database of that. And that's becoming more and more popular. You're saying that there's going to be stationary things that do this all over the town?
Right. That's one of the worries they have, and the fact that they have this license plate scanning. It may be that on moving police cars may be more an issue or less. But the issue is
any of those intersections that have a camera on them for detecting a doing a ticket, you know, doing a traffic violation, those could theoretically be running all the time.
Right, but this is something specifically here. They're talking about Washington D.C.
Okay,
and they're talking about the fact that there is one of these license plate scanners per square mile, or more than one per square mile. Yeah. And if they're running a dragnet on something, that density is going to increase. And they store that data in a database for 3 years.
Whoa.
Which means
we better describe a little bit about how this works and really get an idea of what the scanning means.
Mm-hmm.
It means that a camera passively looking will, every time it sees the license plate, will log when it sees the license plate to its database and the location it's at.
Which is a lot easier problem than what we've been hearing about in recent years about face recognition.
Right.
That's a hard problem.
Interesting.
Seeing a uniform font a license plate with, you know, dark text on light or light on dark is a much simpler problem, much easier to distinguish.
You know, in the movies, they always have these satellite devices that scan down and look at the license plate, you know, and they're tracking bad guys in the Bond kind of movie, which is not, every time you see that, you go, yeah, right. And the chance of that happening, I don't think so. If you're in a desert environment, maybe a little bit better.
Yeah, especially in real time.
It's just too detailed. We have cameras in space that can do that.
Yeah, and they can look at one particular spot that they're interested in.
Right.
But to have canvassing the entire North American continent is... Yeah.
But this is quite easy, right? You get all these feeds from these cameras, and you theoretically just have a database pinging every time it sees a license plate. So one every square mile, that means if you're in D.C. with a car...
More than one every square mile.
If you're in D.C. with a car... it's easily to find out what your path of direction was and everything, which makes it a little creepy. Who has access to this data? You know, these questions start arising.
But the issue that I had when we had the San Jose police officer on was not, this should not be a tool available to the police. It was more of the issue of, for example, this data that is stored in a database for 3 years has the date, time, location, license plate number of everyone, not just people that they're looking for. This isn't doing a hit on, in the case of the San Jose police officer we had on, it was, they had a particular set of cars that they were looking for, a stolen car list, and they were looking to see for a hit when they went through a mall, which is one thing, as opposed to catching everyone, even people who have done nothing wrong, who have no, their licenses up to date, they have no outstanding warrants, whatever, that you're keeping this data to know exactly where they went for the last 3 years, essentially. That is where it's really harder for me to defend or even say that there's a viable second side of the story.
Right. You're talking about, like, the easiest way to set the system up is to log every car license plate you see in every location and then store it. And then, you know, figuring out to purge it or not is actually kind of a complicated problem. But if you let that data create this large database of that, now later someone could subpoena that as public record information and use it in a lawsuit about, something, I don't want to say trivial, but let's say some spouse is cheating on another spouse. Theoretically, there's a record there of where they were and when they were. And you could use that in an alimony case, for example. I mean, it becomes a record that then is a question of when you want to use it as a society and not. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a little creepy. Like, I do want the police to be able to find the stolen car. I do want the police to, you know, get a search warrant and go, yes. But I think it'd be better if that database was used for a search warrant. And I think it'd also be better if you terminated that data over a certain period of time. Though, you know, if
I was actually
thinking
along the lines of, you scan the data, you see what license plate number it is, you check it against the existing database of infractions.
Yeah.
And if there is no infraction, the data is never stored.
Okay, but what about this scenario? I mean, there's never... let's say someone gets murdered. The case is not solved. And 15 years later, you're actually able to look back and find out where the cars were, and you figure out, hey, you know what? This car, we didn't even know, was in that vicinity at that time. Let's find out who that person was. And then you get a conviction, right? So you can see it being a tool that's useful even for tracking non-violating vehicles.
Right, but if you use that logic, then it also becomes pertinent to say, well, we have all these people in the area that there was a robbery, so let's search, frisk every single person that happens
in that
to be
area.
In that block.
Well,
because you're
one.
Going to be a lot more effective at crime control.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the society we want to live in.
Right, right. This really comes down to the question of the society balance. And so these questions, these issues need to be resolved at a political level, but they're very complicated as well, right? I mean, and this kind of stuff's going to get easier and easier. Like right now, it's police forces that have this. But a private network could be done, created no problem by a company. I mean, it wouldn't cost anything for a company to do it.
And technology is getting to the point now where someone could set up a webcam and set up software that does OCR in real time as a car goes by and be able to track everything that goes by the house.
The other thing is, as this data becomes knowledge, as everybody knows this data, if you were to want to commit a crime, all you have to do is take your license plate off or put somebody else's license plate on your vehicle or, you know, trade vehicles with someone, steal a vehicle. Like, mm-hmm. criminals can get past this by just being aware that that's one more thing they have to do. It's not really going to stop anybody. So anyway, we should go on with some other content. you're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam. We're going to take calls with questions and comments about technology. You're welcome to give us a call right now. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I want to let you know that everything we talk about on the show, as I talk about fire and ovens and all these different things we're talking about, we're logging it to our website. And we upload the site about half an hour after the show ends, about an hour after the show ends. So everything we talk about, you can find out more by going to geekspeak.org. And today's show, of course, is the 26th of November, 2011. You got a geek bit and I do too, so you start.
You ever wonder how many servers different companies or entities have and they're using in a time? For example, you may think about, say, Facebook. Facebook has roughly 30,000 servers. Like, a lot of people have a website, you know, it may have one or two machines that are serving. Facebook has 30,000. Then you look at companies that are doing the hosting themselves, not a customer of it, but the one who provides it, like Rackspace. They're a little over 56,000.
Wow.
And then you have one of the folks that makes the technology that is used by those providers and by their customers, like Intel. And they have 100,000 servers.
I mean, it's not their servers that are running. It's servers they've sold that has their tech?
Or no,
their
servers. It's servers that they're running.
What? Why is Intel running that many servers?
Because
they can.
Because they're because they're designing chips. They have to design the fabrication labs that they make those chips with. They got to
do more than
do simulations with that. No, they're doing a lot of stuff. They're also doing a lot of R&D.
When I think of massive amounts of server needs, I think about the internet, like lots of users. But I guess there's other reasons for it as well. Supercomputers, things like that.
Yes.
All right. Okay, so
and a surprise, what about the largest phone provider in the U.S., AT&T? How many servers do they have?
Probably a lot. I don't know. I'm going to guess 50,000.
20,000.
That's it.
They have fewer servers than Facebook.
Well, that makes sense.
They're a common carrier. They don't necessarily need to have all of those servers around to do that work.
Also, their servers are much more dedicated to what they're doing. They're not universal machines in some sense. Mm-hmm. They've got hardware in them that do a lot of switching.
So I'll leave you then with this one.
Google. Wait a second. Do you have Amazon on the list? Because Amazon's got the whole cloud thing, and it's pretty massive.
I actually don't have Google or Amazon handy.
You know, and I'm thinking Apple's doing a lot for iTunes and for music sharing, for video sharing, but I bet you they don't share what their numbers are. So I don't know about Apple.
Yeah, Amazon, Microsoft, eBay, those companies actually don't disclose their number, but they each have over 50,000.
But Google came from education environments. They love sharing their data. What's up?
Take a guess. How many servers?
200,000. Up higher? Yeah, that little thumb thing doesn't work.
Yeah.
500,000?
Keep going.
No. Is it 600, 700, 750,000?
Over a million.
Machines.
And it's speculated that Google owns more than 2% of all the world servers.
Oh my gosh.
So take 100 servers. Google owns at least two of them.
So next time I'm with a client and we're talking about their Drupal install, and I'm like, it's kind of slow because it's, you know, well, Google's fast. That's why.
That's why.
Because most of the time they got a computer answering every question.
That's why they have a response for your search in, you know, 50 milliseconds.
Over a million servers. I mean, how do you even deal with numbers that big? Those don't even make any sense to a human brain. I mean,
that's why Google hires PhDs.
Okay, so it's now the holiday season where you're going to buy stuff. You're going to buy a lot of stuff. And Geek Speak, we're always talking about technology. We're always talking about the newest, fun, great thing. And therefore, we kind of promote this idea of a capitalistic world, a world where you consume, consume, consume. But Miles and I are actually not very much like that, right? I've got my own chickens. By the way, we had a chicken disaster. We lost most of our flock from a dog. Really depressing. But we, you know, compost, we home garden, right? You're involved with a garden project.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of what we're like is not about the buy the newest, shiniest thing. But we talk about the newest
shiny
thing all
the time.
Well, that
and the fact that
we're poor. Yeah, that too. We do silly things like volunteer time.
We got families.
So I want to mention one thing that's a technology-supported thing that you can spend money on that will actually help save the world. And this is a site called Kiva. It's kiva.org. It's an organization, K-I-V-A. Links will be up on geekspeak.org. It's a nonprofit organization with a mission to connect people through lending to alleviate poverty. And what this basically means is leveraging the idea that we have some disposable income that we spend on stupid gifts every year, right? We do a lot of things with our money because we are relatively wealthy.
Hey, it's not stupid. Just because this last Black Friday had more participants than the last presidential election does not mean that it's frivolous.
Oh, my gosh. So here's the thing. Some people in the world need a little bit of money, just some capital investment in what they're doing to open a market, to get better delivery mechanisms. This is a million different ways that people need a little bit of money to invest in a way of lifestyle to improve their lifestyle, right? So, for example, you take a family, you give them a goat, and all of a sudden they've got milk. They can produce offspring if they've got two. They can get a lamb. They can have wool, right? There's a whole bunch of resources that comes around, but they still have to get that animal, and that's actually not as expensive as you'd think for people like us. So, instead of going and giving a $25 gift certificate to, you know, for the local Barnes and Nobles or some Blockbuster store. Instead, what you do is you go ahead and go on to Kiva.org. You put in $25. You can then give that as a gift to somebody else. And those people get to go and take a look at all the different people that need money around the world. Then they designate that $25 gift that goes to Kiva as a loan. The loan goes to the people that need it. The person buys the goat. After a certain period of time, they're selling goat's milk in their community. They make the money back. They give the money back to the Kiva organization, and it gets to go again.
With a little bit of interest.
And a little bit of interest. That's right. It's a fully capitalistic model, mm-hmm. Okay? Which, in some ways, really, it's not a charity thing. So some of the numbers that I think from Kiva are really fascinating. They've lended money to 643,000 people, 643,000 people. $262 million of loans have been given out. And
what's the return on that? How many people pay it back?
98.93%. 98% return. Actually, 99% return. That means that out of, 100 people that you loan to, only one person fails on that loan. That's an amazing...
That's a lot better than in the U.S. even before the housing crunch.
Yeah, you can also assume that 1% that didn't actually return, it actually still benefited their environment, right? They were able to maybe get a goat, maybe the goat died, or maybe some other problem emerged where they weren't able to pay back, or they decided not to pay back, or death mm-hmm. and family, whatever. The initial payment still went to that environment. So even that 1% was a good thing.
Well, you're never going to have 100%.
No, you can't.
But at the same time, that an almost 99% return rate is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's really cool. So you make a loan to Kiva, and then you can get updates through the entire process. When you make the loan, you get to pick the borrower, the person that's actually that your money's going to go to. And when you do it as a gift, you buy it, then you give it to somebody else, and then they get to go online and find the person that they think's right. So you get to actually hear these short stories, which are kind of cool, about the people that need the money and what they're going to use the money for. So I'm just going to get someone at random. Jacqueline, she's from Rwanda. It's in a food area and food production and sales. Jacqueline is a 51-year-old and has 9 children between the ages of 8 and 32. She sells cassava in a store she has run for over 30 years. And she needs something to improve that story. I won't go on. But that's the kind of story you get. A picture from a camera phone of the person. It's really cool. So I highly recommend doing that instead. So let's go ahead and take calls. Again, the phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-655-5877. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Brinks Awards and Signs, located in Santa Cruz on Benito Avenue near Branca Forta and Water, specializing in engraving, plaques, trophies, signs, memorials, and personalized gifts. Now open on Saturdays online at BrinksAwards.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. We're taking calls at 1-800-655-5877. And I guess the first call we will take, if it's okay with you, Miles, is we'll go ahead and go to Sean in Pacific Grove. And Sean, you say it's sunny in Pacific Grove right now?
It is.
It's sunny here in Santa Cruz as well. Enough. It's quite nice.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
So, AT&T pushed U-verse on me. I had my whole system in my house working very well. I had the old wired DSL box plugged into a little iTunes, little air, whatever thing it is, airport. Sure. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a big house, but it's big enough from where the phone jack is to the other side. The wireless connection wasn't good enough, so we bought a time capsule. Mm-hmm. Had a problem with extending the wireless network, mm-hmm. but I was able to figure it out. Now they pushed U-verse, and I got this big wireless DSL box.
Okay.
I thought that, so I took out my old wired DSL modem and the airport, and I still had, because I have all my movies right. on my mm-hmm. time machine.
Right.
So I plugged in the two-wire, whatever it is, mm-hmm. DSL wireless box, and I went over to my other side, to the time capsule, to extend my wireless connection so that the other half of the house could get it. And it wouldn't do that.
Most likely because it has a different chip, a wireless chip vendor, yeah.
Yeah, the protocols for wireless sharing and such is really vendor-based, right? So Apple sells their products. They make sure their devices can connect to each other. Other devices might not be able to connect to each other to share networks.
Yeah, Apple devices use a Broadcom chip, so anything that has a Broadcom usually will be able to communicate. But if something uses a Raylink or an Atheros, then you're... Yeah.
You've got a simple solution, though. Your old DSL modem, was it a modem router or just... Was it a wireless router as well or just a modem?
The one from before?
Yeah.
Won't work with the new U-verse system.
No, I know, but did it have wireless in it or not?
No.
Okay.
And it only had one port to go out to a switch or whatever. Right.
So the new one, it's got wireless capabilities, the new U-verse DSL modem. It's got wireless capabilities. Does it also have an Ethernet port on it?
It has four.
Okay, so this is a really easy solution. What you do is you log into your wireless, your new U-verse DSL modem thing that costs a lot of money, and go ahead and turn off its wireless and plug into your old wireless solution and go back to your old wireless solution and just don't use their wireless. Just turn it off and plug it directly in. Just because they have the feature on, that doesn't mean you have to use it. It's not compatible with your other gear. Get rid of it. I mean, keep the device, but just turn off the wireless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to transfer movies from iTunes to the computer, and the time capsule was right next to the computer. I couldn't figure out how to plug the computer into the time capsule and plug the time capsule into the, the Ethernet.
I mean, you can do that way, too. You can plug in your time capsule directly into your router as well. I mean, what's going to happen is every one of these devices that's a router is going to become create another separate subnetwork, and it becomes kind of complicated. I wish this stuff was as easy to explain and describe to people as it is for me and you, Miles, to understand it. Like, we could get into that environment and go, okay, I know what we're going to do here. But first off, you had to work
the environment. It doesn't make it easy. Like, we can understand it, but it's even when we're setting up, networking to span multiple routers, it's still not – it's not turnkey.
I Googled this. I mean, I did go Google, and you guys came on the radio. I'm all, I'll ask these guys. They'll figure it out.
So definitely just go back to your old setup. Just use the new router modem.
Turn off the wireless.
And then plug in directly. Good luck.
And so can I ask one last quick question?
Sure.
Why is transfer speed so much slower over my in-house wireless? Like, I can download a movie offline, and it'll come in at a lot faster than even transferring a movie from my time capsule to my computer.
Well, you're probably having wireless handshake problems. Your time capsule, is your time capsule providing the wireless?
No.
Okay, so what it has to do is it has to connect. Is it connected physically or wirelessly to your wireless router?
Wirelessly.
Yeah,
actually wouldn't matter as much because the time capsule hard drives are just not
as fast
when they're transferring information. The hard drives are fast enough to saturate that link, but
it's a wireless problem.
But whenever you set up most NASs, network attached storage, whenever you set one of those up, they're almost never going at what the hard drive can do.
No, I get that, but think about this. You've got your time capsule. It's wirelessly connected to a router or a wireless hub, and then you've got another handshake to your computer from that wireless hub. That's two handshakes on the same channels. So now, every time I communicate some data, I've got to then bounce. I'm going to conflict.
Yeah, but if it's an end network, you're going pretty fast.
Yeah, if it's an end network, which it might be.
But so I plugged in. I had an old NAS. I plugged into the DSL mm-hmm. box, and it was transferring at very slow speeds, just as the time capsule was wirelessly.
Yeah, I mean,
so I was going wired.
It's actually really difficult to find out if your wireless stuff is going at top performance. Any kind of problems with noise and stuff in that environment just slows the whole thing down. It doesn't mean it keeps going fast and then, there's a problem, therefore it stops. Instead, it just slows everything down. Just like a hard drive failing, it'll actually slowly fade out and you'll get slower and slower performance from it. Same with a wireless activity. If you can remove all your wireless and hardwire everything, your speeds will be incredibly faster. And you could probably do a lot of that. So
mainly for compatibility issues.
Yeah, but also for collisions. If you have a whole bunch of traffic going on the same environment over the same channels of wireless, only some can happen at certain times. And the handshaking protocol is actually kind of expensive from a bandwidth perspective. So the more hopping you do, the worse it gets. Now, keeping that in mind, I'm hopping three hops away to access another building, and they can stream Netflix. I mean, if you do it and you don't have a lot of collisions, you're set. The problem is the collision stuff is not built in. You can't see it very easily. So you have to get other types of tools. So, like, Miles and I are constantly getting these WTR. What are those?
WRT. They're Linksys.
Linksys routers. Yeah. You can install your own version of Linux
or
on them.
Cisco Linksys, yeah.
Yeah, and therefore people have made these binaries that are called Tomato.
Yeah,
and
I heard those about things that a few years ago.
Yeah, those things allow you to see a lot more of the data. You can't do it with the chipset you have in the Apple stuff. And besides, Apple's hardware's or software management stuff is so easy and fun to use, it's kind of hard to go away. But what you really want to do is think about your data flow and try to remove the amount of different wireless hops it has to do. Additionally, if a wireless access point has two antennas, can handle two different things, it means that if you set it up correctly, you could be receiving on one channel and sending on another channel. You'll notice that also set up your network to be automatic channels, most likely. That'll help you out. But that's enough on this.
There's the avalanche of data. Sorry about that.
I just never, you got some great angles and I'll totally figure it out.
Right.
If I don't, I'll call you next week.
Yeah, send us a note if you do too. I'd love to hear it when people succeed. That'd be great. Thank you, Sean.
I will, I'll send you an email. Okay, thank you guys so much. Have a good morning.
From Santa Cruz, Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello, Lyle.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good,
Steve.
Good.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Here's my question. I've got a fairly common system in my house. I've got a D-Link router. I've got my desktop wired directly to the router and my two printers. And then I use the wireless for my laptop. And then I got my new iPad 2. You've seen my iPad 2. I just love the thing. The problem is that every once in a while, the router messes me up. I guess it doesn't like the iPad. And it changes the IP address on the iPad. And I'm still in communication with the router, but I can't get on the network. I can't get on the internet.
Okay.
And I've tried everything through, renewing the lease to doing a hard reset. The only way for me to get it back to a normal IP address is to go downstairs, unplug the router, and plug it back in again.
Okay. And are you using anything else for the wireless router? Any other devices?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Are you using any other wireless devices that are served by that wireless D-Link?
Yeah, my laptop.
Okay, and that doesn't have that problem?
No.
Okay, interesting. So the first thing I would do is if you go into the web interface of your D-Link, you'll be able to see the DHCP for the wireless. This is the dynamic host client protocol. This is the thing that actually gives out IP addresses. And in that space, what you could do is you could find out what's called the MAC address. You probably know what that is. The iPad actually has an ID in its wireless configuration. It'll be in the logs of your D-Link. Go ahead and set that thing to be a hard-coded IP. And what that means is every time it sees that, if it has a DHCP request, it's going to get the same IP address. What happens with DHCP service is there's actually a built-in feature to cycle through the IP addresses. And sometimes a cheaper device like this, like a home unit, will actually switch out every 60 days or something. Will give a new IP address to its devices if it's asked. And it's not exactly a useful situation in your environment because you have one device. I think that something else is actually problematic with your device, your router.
I don't know about the D-Link, whether or not it's available on your particular model or whatnot, but there's also many routers you can set the lease time on the DHCP.
Yeah.
So you may want to see if you can bump that up to a much higher number.
The other thing to do if you still, after all those things, still run into this problem is install a new BIOS on your D-Link. And that takes, normally, unfortunately, a Windows machine to do that with. But it's basically grabbing the newer drivers from them, BIOS, actually.
I've updated the firmware on there.
Yeah. Well, then definitely take a look at lease time.
Like I said, it puts on, what it does is it assigns it a strange address. I mean, normally when it's working, it's a very common looking address, 192.168.0.0.0.3. But when it goes into this weird mode, it comes up with a 169 number.
169?
Which means that it's not getting a response from the DHCP server. Right.
Yeah, that means that the iPad wants to connect and get an IP address and the other machine doesn't have one. Now, the other thing
the router just hasn't responded.
It means the router is failing to give IP addresses or respond to DHCP, which I could see happening in that the iPod might be more gentle with how it requests, and the Windows or the wireless laptop might be more aggressive in its request, if you will, and therefore its full stack request is a little different, and therefore the router wakes up and responds to the DHCP request, and the iPad's not doing that. So that's a possibility. What you could also do is you could manually set your IP for that wireless network and not get the DHCP setting. So when it sees your, Steve at home wireless access point, it would use that, but then manually have the IP address instead of DHCP. I think the iPad can do that. I'm not totally certain.
Well, I'll take a look at that.
Steve, good luck. Let me know how it goes. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
All right, Lynn from San Jose was calling about Kiva. What's up, Lynn?
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Have you ever used Kiva?
No, and I was driving. Well, I wasn't driving. Well, I was driving when I heard 2 minutes of your piece on Kiva, so I got pretty excited. Now I pulled over in the parking lot, so I'm not driving. I served in Vista many years ago, which is Volunteers in Service to America. Mm-hmm. And what my question was, Kiva, is there, can it be used in the United States?
I don't know if Kiva has a presence in the U.S. I think one of the issues is the economies of scale or the cost of living, as it were. The U.S. has such a high cost of living that the amount of money that you have to outlay for a loan is comparatively much higher, as opposed to if you have $100, that can go to, 5 or 10 people in a developing country.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's really what it comes down to. I'm trying to figure out if Kiva has service in the United States, and I do not know, unfortunately.
Oh, okay. Well, I really, really appreciate the idea, and that's one of the ways I will give gifts this season. And thanks to you, I really appreciate it.
Okay, so you know what? Actually, there is a partner that does. It's ACCION USA. It's a nonprofit microfinance organization committed to providing microfinance services and small business owners throughout the United States, and they are one of the partners with Kiva. So yes, there is a way to do that. Yeah. It's possible that the way they do that is they concatenate the loans into larger pools. Sometimes people need more than $25, right? They might need a different amount. So, but if the message is enough, they get enough people to commit their loan, then it happens anyway, even at a higher rate. So that definitely looks like there's at least one partner that serves people in the United States.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, there's also the issue of in developing countries, many times they won't have the equivalent of a credit union. And that's one of the issues. That's one of the reasons behind a credit union is everyone pools their money together and then gives out loans to different folks and has it paid back.
It's neat seeing via partner how much money goes through each partner group, For the ACCION, it's actually pretty large. Total loans, $914,000 have gone through them.
Excellent.
181 entrepreneurs through that. So pretty large loans, really.
Yeah.
And a portfolio yield of 23.39%, which means that they're just making some money back, which is kind of cool. Anyway, there you go. Thank you so much for the call. Again, if you missed Kiva.org is a nonprofit that does micro loans, and you can buy $25 worth of loan money and then decide where it goes in the world to help somebody start their or finish their business or help their business along. And then at the end of that period of time that they need the money, they pay it back, goes back in the Kiva pool, and it gets reassigned. And I think you get to you keep on moving your money around, basically. So the gift keeps on giving, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of cool. And again, that's at kiva.org. And a friend of mine, I think, gave me a gift of it last year. And every time I go to fulfill it, I get caught up hours on reading all the different descriptions. So this is partly to say, go do this too, because it's a great way to spend money, if you will, for holiday season as a gift without using very many resources, except for web resources, I guess. Miles, you have another geek tidbit for us?
Sure. How about the idea of an ocean on Pluto.
I love that idea. What kind of liquid would it be?
Well, what they're talking about, and this is on physorg.com, what they're finding is that it may be possible that there is some ice on Pluto, which wouldn't be all that surprising, but there's a sufficient amount of radioactive heat coming from the core that it is melting some of that ice into liquid water.
Wow.
And we will find out in 2015 whether or not that is the case when NASA's New Horizons satellite, you know, goes by the now dwarf planet.
It's really, really, really cold, that planet. And we're talking, you know, 44 degrees Kelvin.
Although I do have to say, if memory serves, it is not the coldest place in the solar system.
Oh, I'm sure it's not.
I believe around Saturn has that honor.
I think my heart is, actually. No. All right. We are done with calls. Miles, I guess one more. I want to make sure that I got everything I want to talk about today. I think so. So you got one more little story?
Sure. There's a science education prize. It's given by Science Magazine, and it's a prize. It's officially called the Science Prize for Online Resources in Education, or SPOR. And this week's award is going to a project called Open Source Physics. And we'll have a link to the article and a link to the actual software. So if you want to get more involved in physics and how things work, and educational and interesting, check out our website after the show.
Geekspeak.org. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruiseio.com. The holidays are right around the corner, and the 211 helpline wants people to get in need to get connected. A call to 211 can help you find out if you're eligible for holiday assistance, such as free holiday meals, food, and toys. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. This has been Geek Speak. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we appreciate the Puppet Master's use and sharing of his trademark. You know, I say that every week, but I don't always describe what that means. From Heroes, the guy that plays Puppet Master, yeah, that's David Lawrence, and he's been using Geek Speak, I think, the name, shorter period of time than we've been using it, but he registered it, and we've got a great relationship with him. He's been real friendly. And we get to use the name and keep it.
We've had an interview with him on the show before, so please check out our archives. Well.
Yeah, definitely. GeekSpeak has been something that Miles and I have been doing for years. This holiday season, we'll be doing a gift show. We'll have Al Luckow be back next week, which will be fun. And you can learn about everything we talk about on GeekSpeak up at geekspeak.org.
So Crazy USB of the Week's coming back.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to get him to do that. That's a lot of work. But the Crazy USB of the Week's have been wonderful. Maybe I'll pull out one for the archives for next week. I think that'd be fun. Miles, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And Rick, for answering phones, thank you so much. Thanks for listening to Geek Speak on KOSP.